You're on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I mean to plant a flag in the sand for conscious, willful people to gather, organize, empathize, and capsize the established order of things. Our opposition? Team Machine, Team Capitalism, Team Algorithm, Team No Team, I'm my own team. Being human is a team sport, so thanks for playing. Our guest today, one of my very best friends and first true teachers, counterculture legend, Are You Serious, a.k.a. Ken Goffman, founding editor of Mondo 2000. Are You will help us evaluate the place of the counterculture in the digital landscape and join us in our search for hopeful human answers to the deadliest questions of our time. We are intervening on behalf of people. This is Team Human. I don't want to talk long because I want to get right to our guest today, but let me share a passing thought I've had repeatedly over the last couple of weeks as the Russia inquiry escalates and implodes and the Trump administration begins flinging more accusations and tweets and distractions no matter the social or political cost. My insight had nothing really to do with Trump at first. I was embroiled in one of those online battles on a mailing list of media and technology thinkers. The guy who runs the list is really smart, a true genius, but very opinionated and always ready to go on the attack. So to challenge one of his underlying assumptions means that he's going to jump on you like an alt-right troll on Hillary or a gamer gator on a feminist. I guess that's the same thing. But everyone on the list knows this, figuring it's worth cowering and acquiescing lest the central figure come after them. And slowly but surely, this means accepting and internalizing the guy's arguments. It's a version of the Stockholm Syndrome, I suppose, where captives eventually take on the perspectives of their captors. So I figured I'd buck the trend and ask ever so gently whether it might be possible that this list about digital media was falling prey to the biases of digital media itself, that divisive, polarized style of engagement that ends up too determinist, preventing the percolation of more nuanced perspectives. Humans, after all, are nuanced. And oh my God, the shit storm that little question generated was off the charts. My biography, my religion, even the description of Team Human on this site that was written by Stephen Bartolome was dragged into the conference as evidence of my unsuitability and inferiority. The only time I'd seen anything like that before was when a cult leader was attempting to prevent a disciple from leaving his tribe, and maybe a few times on 4chan. But what occurred to me is that we're in a similar position with our president. Like most people, I want to see his administration broken up, arrested for their collusion with the Russians to undermine our democracy, sow discontent, and promote national confusion and despair. And I can't help but get a little excited as Mike Flynn asks for immunity and other bombs begin to drop. But knowing what we already do about Trump, maybe we better be worried about what happens if we truly corner the guy. He's willing to invent a wiretapping scandal to distract from his taxes or a terrorist threat in order to push through an illegal immigration order. And those are minor threats. Trump is an internet troll with the world's biggest arsenal at his disposal. So imagine what he'd do if we really threatened his presidency. If they found out something truly impeachable or jailable. My guess is he wasn't really in on any of the Russia stuff. No, sure, he owes them money, but he's not really crafty enough to be leveraging Russian psyops consciously. They're playing him. You know, they're dropping breadcrumbs of fake stories like Obama's birthplace or wiretapping, knowing he'll pick them up. They're tailor-made bits of paranoia, perfect for Trump's mentality. But if more and more of his people get indicted and arrested, his election itself put into question, or his business dealings reveal impeachable offenses, what do you think he's going to do? Go off quietly into the night? Or create whatever distractions are required to get us off the plot? And if he's already creating this much damage and confusion over questions of character or associates' connections to Russia and tax returns, imagine what he'd do if the press, the courts, or Congress really went after him. The metaphorical bombs could well become real ones. Imagine what a distraction that would be. And if there's a Stockholm syndrome that goes along with this, it's the, don't go after Big Daddy. Don't report the abuser because then we'll see his true wrath. And in this case, it's not imaginary and child services can't protect us. Now, I'm not saying stop, but proceed with caution and make what you do count. You're on Team Human, coming to you alive from the Basement Media Squad at the Laboratory for Digital Humanism. Playing for us today, my friend and tour guide, Are You Serious? You know, for people that don't know us, I don't even know if you know that the first time I came in contact with you and your work, it was like at the first Albert Hofmann Memorial Conference at this, I think it was in a giant Masonic building in Los Angeles. Timothy Leary had told me to go to it, I think, and it must have been in the 80s. And a whole bunch of high frontiers were at that thing. You know, it was like Laura Huxley and, you know, I think Ram Dass or, you know, a bunch of the old original psychedelics crowd and some of the sort of early ecstasy, Bruce Eisner or Bruce Ehrlich, whatever his name was, the ecstasy guy and a bunch of different folks. But then there was High Frontiers, which for me, and I'm sure for a lot of people of my ilk or generation, it was like a calling card from the future. It was this amalgamation of all these different things that I had been interested in and never connected, but all of a sudden they're all in the same place and they're all being declared part of the same, this amalgamation of cultural, scientific, biological, cosmic, spiritual, pharmacological advances. I mean, what did you see as the common thread? How did physics and math and drugs and music and culture and transgender and cultural alchemy all end up in the same, considered part of the same potpourri of cultural information?
I think it melded together in some ways. It just melded together in my head, and I assumed that there were other people out there like me. It's sort of like what Paul Krassner said about starting The Realist. He put it out to meet the other aliens. And so this was a new generation of aliens. And I think it's very interesting that you found us amidst this crowd that might be considered sort of crusty towards to a lot of people and might have been considered pretty old and not connected to contemporary culture. But yeah, to me, it wasn't just, there was the influence of Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson, but it wasn't just the physics and the science and the oncoming digital age and everything that you just mentioned, the new psychedelics as well. But it was also the fact that as somebody who was in his early mid-20s when punk came along and new wave came along, that I was charged and adapted for a very sort of speedy, hyper futuristic mentality by that as well. There was a vibe, but it's funny to me because I hear from some people, some 20-somethings who worked at Mondo, that High Frontier seemed really crusty and 60s and hippie to them. You get, of course, you always get shot by both sides, but I mean, I think that there was just this amalgamation of interests and curiosities and things going on at that point in time. And one could clearly see the so-called digital revolution coming on, and one could be fairly optimistic about it at that time, actually radically over-optimistic. Yeah, so I mean, it was just get it out there and meet other people who thought like me. Now, when I started the magazine, the other people who came into it were much more into the psychedelics than they were into what I should have called postmodern art or digital culture or futurism or anything like that. So there was a deep dive into psychedelics much more than into the other aspects that we discussed at first. And then we really reversed fields entirely when we started Reality Hackers and then Mondo 2000. So I have to say that was one of the best times I ever had was that deep dive into psychedelics.
Well, I mean, the psychedelics culture of the late 80s, I mean, was different than computer culture or the others because, I mean, we were doing something illegal. You know, it was
right.
It was
almost, well, no, there were some people in computer culture doing some things illegal.
Yeah, that's true, too. You know, it felt like it was a subculture that for a long time, you know, people really needed to find the others, as Timothy, told everybody. And I use as the sort of mantra for this show. There was a real need to find other ones. And when you did, it was like, oh, you take these things, too. You've seen what I've seen. So the High Frontiers kind of more than High Times, because High Times was so, pot oriented. High Frontiers really ran the full gamut of hallucinatory experiences, and kind of it was a flag in the sand saying, yes, there are others. These are your experiences. But yeah, you're right. As you turned into Reality Hackers and then eventually Mondo 2000, it really became the voice of, this 21st century, post-television designer reality society.
Yeah, the Jetsons on DMT, as Mark Derry snarkily labeled it.
And that wasn't a bad thing. I mean, and then luckily, I guess, it also finally a beautiful new culture came along with it, which was the early rave club kid culture, which helped give it an aesthetic that was a lot more pleasing to young people or relevant to young people than, wavy gravy and tie-dye T-shirts.
That's true. Although I have to say that's where I became a crusty myself, because I'm never that enamored of the musical style, and I would always be the one leaving at 4 a.m. rather than staying till dawn. But yeah, I mean, it was an incredible flowering of a new kind of optimism, very reminiscent of late 60s hippie optimism. I mean, the idea, the feeling that we could change everything at once, because now we had the technology and it was distributed all over the world. And this sort of the idea of the good vibe and all that at that time, that was pretty amazing.
And everything did change at once, but maybe not exactly as we thought. I always blamed Wired magazine and the investment ethos for changing the internet from an anything can happen, new human potential movement into the same old, expansion of capital through, IPOs and digital companies. But I mean, what is it, I hate to even term it like this, but what went wrong? Why didn't we get the everything changing at once for the human better that we were all imagining up in the Berkeley Hills in the Mondo 2000 living room?
Well, I think we thought abundance would come faster. Material abundance, perhaps, as well as digital and abundance of ideas and information and so forth, that all that stuff would come together much more quickly, and it would lead to a kind of collapse of the barriers, of the turnstiles between the stuff that people want that's replicable. And we thought that physical material was going to become replicable much faster than it has, if it ever will. So
you mean more like a Star Trek replicator type thing, more than 3D printers?
Nanotech, people were fantasizing that nanotech was going to happen very fast. I mean, even Al Gore threw a secondhand conversation I learned was, you know, dreaming of, was thinking, worried that the singularity was going to happen during his term as president. And obviously neither of those things happened, you know. I mean, capitalism was there, and it was waiting to go online, and, you know, it kind of crapped up a lot of things. It performed some services in some ways as well. And, you know, that's the conundrum that we're stuck with now.
Yeah, I mean, it feels as if capitalism is much more suited for the net than humans or culture are. You know, capitalism's abstract of the three factors of production, you know, land, labor, and capital. Capital's the only one that can expand infinitely. It's not true. Real.
Yeah, we don't even need to have any humans left. One of the things that a lot of the techno-optimists, more towards the post-wire period, late 90s and on into the 21st century, you know, would talk about how vast the stock market would grow. I mean, that was the long boom, you know. Instead of talking about a vast increase in intelligence or material wealth or all these other factors, if you go back and read that Wired issue, so much emphasis was just on how high the stock market would grow. This abstraction would just, you know, expand unto infinity. And I mean, to some extent, I almost got sold. I was like ready for the trickle down. You know, if it gets big enough, then everything is going to be given away for free to everybody. Or at least that was the sort of capitalist theory of post-scarcity. And that theory is still being out there.
Yeah, exactly. I was ready to open my mouth, lean my head back, and get the trickle down too.
Yeah. I mean, I finally got a job and I was well paid, and I thought, okay, you know, and then bam, as soon as I was ready to lighten up about the whole thing, it crashed. Yeah.
Well, and part of that's because, I mean, we weren't given ownership.
Yeah.
That's the problem with capitalism, the way it's currently configured anyway. You know, we didn't own these networks, so they were really just extracting more value than they were giving us. So, I mean, do you think it's mainly this sort of capitalism being able to infuse the net so completely, or do you think it was that we weren't really ready culturally or on a consciousness level to do what the net was suggesting, to really, you know, connect with other people on this new level?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're talking about counterculture people or post-counterculture people or psychedelic people or whatever, I mean, we're sort of the other 1%, and the large group out there of, you know, the masses, so to speak, came online, and the coming together of the global mind or what have you, it did not prove to be so delightful as, you know, John Perry Barlow or whomever might have hoped. And in fact, what we realize is that disembodied minds, particularly, familiarity breeds not just contempt, but, you know, probably death threats from moment to moment. You know, we hate the, you know, Sartre said, hell is other people. And I think hell is other people's tweets and Facebook posts and so forth.
I know.
And
I
they
know.
Just so irritate the crap out of all of us mutually.
I know. Part of me thinks, you know, back to what you were talking about earlier, that it's almost as if internet users had some kind of a psychedelic training before they went online. They would be better prepared for the kind of social interaction.
It could help, although I mean, there's certainly plenty of intolerant psychedelic users online as well. And I mean, just in terms of people believing bizarre stuff, I mean, that's something. That's a whole other discussion of one of the consequences of the psychedelic revolution that I find far more irritating and consequential, whereas I found it benign and amusing in the past.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I remember you and I kind of bonded again 20 years after we met, or whatever it was, after 9/11 and some of the more extreme conspiracy theories were going around.
Yeah.
you know, that we both took a lot of heat for not buying into them. You know, I wrote a piece where I was arguing that, you know, these are the disinformants who are spreading these stories because they're trying to keep us from seeing the simple basic truth of what happened, which is horrible enough.
Right.
But it feels like that then, you know, 9/11 and the acceleration of conspiracy theory that it spawned, combined with the internet and the ability to, you know, to connect anything to anything else, has yielded this, whatever you want to call it, this bizarre world of ontological relativism that we're in today, where people can be so easily manipulated and drawn into these rabbit holes of false truths.
Yeah, I'm sorry I blew up consensus reality, man. yeah, Operation Mindfuck was too successful.
People are, take responsibility for it. Do you think the counterculture did this?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think, if you follow some of the ideological discourse from a couple of people who are really influential in Russia with Putin, Operation Mindfuck is applied to amoral raw power and political strategy. And, you know, I mean, there was a guy on Facebook for a while, I think he was authentic, who was sort of, at least in some ways, part of Putin's mind trust. And he was totally into O'Leary and Operation Mindfuck. And he was always talking about how everybody knew about all that stuff. I mean, that's just one aspect of it. But yeah, I think the net certainly contributed to this situation where people could get sort of trapped in their own reality bubbles and only hear from the people that they want to hear from and see the things that they want to see. But yeah, I mean, I think that one of the consequences of postmodernism and of relativistic thinking and so forth is that people who are less sophisticated or mentally troubled can take that in some very troubling directions.
I mean, there used to be a counterculture. No, I mean, not necessarily an organized counterculture, but at least some kind of a coherent counterculture to engage with these kinds of issues and push culture ahead. I mean, you know, your book, Counterculture Through the Ages, really shows the not just the styles of counterculture through the ages, but the function of counterculture through the age. And I'm wondering, is a counterculture even possible in a networked age? You know, or maybe is humanity itself the counterculture in a digital environment?
Yeah, I mean, actually, if you go back and look at the book, even then, when the book came out in 2004, I said, is counterculture still counter anymore, both at the beginning and at the end of the book? Yeah, I mean, there, without a consensus culture to play off of, and I think in many ways to parasitize off of mutually, and in many ways that was a healthy thing. The discussion of counterculture in some ways in the contemporary context becomes sort of moot. You have a lot of people going around now. There's a very popular video by some guy saying conservatism is the new counterculture. Very popular meme among alt-right and all those kinds of people. And I mean, my response mainly is that it's moot. I'm not that interested in bragging about being counterculture anymore, except, you know, maybe when it comes to music or something like that, be outrageous within that context. But within the context of politics and culture more broadly, I'm interested in what I can say and do that contributes to survival and, you know, advancement. And I'm not going to worry about whether it's counterculture or not.
Well, and as I observe you, I don't look at you as counterculture at all. I mean, you're pro-culture.
That's right. Yeah,
it's pro-culture. The other guys that are counter.
Yeah, I know. I guess Terrence McKenna said culture is not your friend, but I never really followed that argument.
No, we're all in a culture. I mean, he must have had some logic to
it. It was some far out thing, being virally occupied, which is a legitimate point.
So now your music, you know, your writing and production and performance has been sort of weaving through this all along. I mean, before High Frontiers, you were in upstate New York in a band.
Yeah. It's frustrating because, you know, once you get pigeonholed into one area, particularly with music, people don't want to know. The actor who tries to form a rock band is treated to a great deal of snark and so forth.
Yeah, well, defy anybody's expectations of what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
You know, even you write a book, you know, 1 degree different from the one you wrote before. And it's like, wait a minute, you've radically changed.
Yeah, like, no. Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's, you know, that's Adorno. And, you know, as long as we're cultural products, we're supposed to be predictable and the same. It's
right.
Like you're not allowed to do something else. But how you could trace your kind of your music interests, you know, from then through Mondo Vanilli to now. I mean, that'd be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what happens with me is by accident, both lyrically and musically. And I think that's true for a lot of people. It's a question of who's around, who you hook up with. I know the punk vibe has always been there. And it's this place where I can go where I don't have to write essays.
You know, and you started, how old were you when you were in that first band?
I was 29 when I was in Party Dog. I actually had recording situation before that in the mid-70s, which unfortunately the tapes are gone. I finally gained the confidence to step up to a microphone at about 23. I mean, the through line with it all is kind of you play with whoever you can hook up with. You know, I never tried to do something that was edgy in the same way that Mondo 2000 was. I think maybe Mondo Vanilli kind of ended up being that way.
Mondo Vanilli was meant as a kind of a cultural satire of there was the Milli Vanilli scandal, I guess, for young people who don't remember. It was a band that got caught, you know, that they're lip syncing and there's other people are singing the music for them.
Yeah.
And then so Mondo Vanilli came out, which was kind of a hybrid of, as I understood it, Mondo 2000 and the sort of the Milli Vanilli media virus joke.
So, I'm sitting in a coffee shop and I'm reading the San Francisco Chronicle about Milli Vanilli being roasted alive for lip syncing. And I'm right in the middle of a period where people are just making a huge fuss about virtual reality. And so I'm thinking, first of all, Milli Vanilli sucks totally. So that's one so what. And they shouldn't have won any awards. And then the other so what is, so what if they're lip syncing? Why go through the cliche of having a live band on stage? Why do cliched videos with people holding guitars? So the idea was to form a virtual reality band, which was very premature in terms of the kind of technology that was available at that time. And then basically, I mean, Scrappy Duchamp and I, we'd been writing music together for a while, actually. And it was, like I said, it was sort of poppy. It was a little techno, but it was sort of poppy. And I just thrusted a bunch of industrial music and electronica and rave music on him. And I said, you know, figure this stuff out and let's write some new songs for Mondo Vanilli. So he took his influences, which are more like sort of somewhere at the intersection of Brian Wilson and Frank Zappa, you know, and then filtered that through the industrial music that he hated. And we came up with Mondo Vanilli.
I know. And now, I mean, now there are virtual bands, you know, there's that touring Japanese pop girl who's, you know, they throw a little smoke on the stage and you get a 3D avatar in performance doing all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
So I guess it was more than a thought experiment, but it's real.
Yeah.
It's realized.
It's terribly real. Yes.
And now today you have new music.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been getting lyrics around to a lot of different people. And this is sort of the start of working with a bunch of different people on what I hope might be an album, an eclectic album of various styles of music. The early ones, particularly the two, Punching a Nazi and Be My Valerie Solanas, sort of in the style, I'm told it's in the style of 1980s or 1990s industrial.
Let's play a clip of that, Punching a Nazi.
Nazi Albert Camus wouldn't bring back the Stasi. Shepherd is Posse.
All right, so who is that performing?
Okay, that's Charles Verretti. He calls himself Creosote Cowboy. Then there's a guy who calls himself Pizza T. His main band is Friends with a PH. And I've done several things with him. He actually did a remix of a song called President Mussolini Makes the Planes Run on Time, which was written right after the election of Ronald Reagan, but which we reapplied to the campaign and then the election of Donald Trump with appropriate samples right. And so forth.
So the Punching a Nazi song, though, is a reference specifically to that guy who punched the Nazi during the television interview.
Yeah, I mean, that's what brought it to mind. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Although, I mean, if you read the lyrics and listen to the song, you know, the feeling is much more the Ramones than, some hardcore political group. I mean, to me, it was one of those rare cases where I actually was hearing another lyricist in my head. I was hearing Joey Ramone. I was hearing Beat on the Brat in my head when I wrote the lyrics. So I give myself an out in terms of the song being ambiguous enough that I'm not telling people to go out and punch a Nazi. I'm certainly not going to stop them if they decide to. But I think some people are afraid of the song because they think it's advocacy of violence.
Just as anything you've done, people would think everything that you're talking about, you're advocating rather than looking, talking, wondering. I mean, you can marvel at something without endorsing it, but it's really tricky today.
I should also mention the vocalist on that song, but I'm not remembering her stage name, but her name is Kate, who added some of the vocals to both those songs, that and Be My Valerie Solanas. Mm. Could be the least commercial song ever, just in terms of the names that are dropped in the song are only recognizable to intellectuals and people with some idea of history.
Let's play a drop of Be My Valerie Solanas.
Some gum. Offer her most anything, don't offer her my gun. Offer her to Beauvoir, offer her to Sun. Keep your knees together, have some faith in God.
Okay, so that's not a commercial hit.
It's not that
at least not yet, but I mean, You're like, God, I don't even know what to say. It's almost like you're a whatever the 21st century equivalent of a Frankfurt group theorist is.
I would go for that. I would hope that whatever I put together could be understood within that context. Definitely.
Well, it does seem it's about the cultural production of itself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, this goes back. I mean, it goes all the way back, I'm sure, to everything I wrote, but it goes specifically back to a song by Mondavinili called Love is the Product, you know, which was very explicitly, you know, the medium is the message, money makes it dance, love is the product, the joke is in your pants. Okay, so there's a cheap joke at the end of it, but it's still, you know, that's what it's about, yeah.
Right. It's funny, I'm just kind of putting out a book proposal now, and of course my agent wants me to go with a major publisher, you know, so we get in advance and all.
Yeah.
And I keep thinking about Walter Benjamin saying, you know, the means of production are the product, you know.
Yeah.
You can't separate your content from the means of production. Otherwise, you know, every record is just selling more plastic and every book is just selling more, you know, Bertelsmann stock. And I'm finally at the point where I can see, oh my gosh, that's actually true. You know, and I worry sometimes, how can we create culture without, you know, feeding the machine more than we starve it?
Yeah, I mean, I try not to be too purist about things, as you know. But, I mean, that's always been there. And actually with Mondo Vanilli, we had a philosophy of authentic inauthenticity. And we contrasted that with inauthentic authenticity. And you know, had the idea that, look, Bruce Springsteen, you know, I like Bruce, but, it, you know, he is someone who comes to you through media. He's a mediated piece of abstract authenticity. So, we wrote this philosophy. I was embracing David Bowie and Andy Warhol and people like that and contrasting them favorably to people who had the pretense of authenticity. I don't think that's necessarily what I'm trying to do right now. You know, I think all the cultural codes are pretty much totally scrambled at this point. Mm. You know, I'd be happy to go out with somebody with a guitar and sing live and enjoy the real authentic experience or whatever. But I kind of take all that stuff as it comes.
I mean, the part that's amazing to me, and I mean this as a compliment, not as a diss, is how hard it is for you to actually, even personally, survive and thrive in the current cultural environment. You know, so here you are, one of, you know, the I don't even need to put it on a rating scale, but one of the major movers and thinkers of this time. And I know on a daily basis, you're thinking about, how am I going to make ends meet? Is there a job around? Is there money around? Is there a gig that I can grab to get by, you know, these next 3-4 weeks? That seems to me not only profoundly unjust, but strange. Do you know what I mean?
It is strange. Yeah. You know, I never knew what the key was, why Mondo 2000 gained a mass audience and other things didn't gain a mass audience that were equally deserving. You know, it hit a cultural moment and hit a cultural spot. In contrast with Wired, it hit the spot too soon. But for us, we hit a sweet spot at a particular moment. But I've never been able to really quite figure out, you know, what makes people go and purchase something. People will like something, but what makes them go and purchase something? That I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I'm not sure why my analysis of culture doesn't, you know, bring the boys out into the yard, so to speak. You know, but at some point, there's certainly some exhaustion on my part. I don't write essays frequently or to some extent ever, because I'm not getting paid for it and I don't feel like doing it. Yeah. And I enjoy writing the lyrics more. I love doing the lyrics, but even there, I don't feel a sense of completion until the stuff starts being listened to, which is still an issue. So thanks for having me on.
Well, I know. At least we'll get the 5 or 10,000 people that listen to this will have at least been force-fed some high nutrition musical musical information. But some of the last stuff that you were writing about, you know, commercially was, and it was early for that too, was, you know, extropianism and transhumanism. And although the publications you were writing for seemed, you know, stridently extropian, I always sensed you kind of kept transhumanism at arm's length as you wrote about it, weren't you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that brand has really been poisoned, I think, almost completely at this point by people like Peter Thiel. This guy, Robert Mercer, who has been shown was the big money behind Trump, is a life extensionist and immortalist and so forth. As the bad guys from a lot of cyberpunk novels, you know, are the complicated, weird guys, at least, that are, you know, sort of going to the forefront of that brand or that idea.
It is weird. I think it's hard for people to realize that. I mean, so it's not just Kurzweil, you know, who might be misguided in terms of wanting to upload his consciousness to a silicon wafer. It's guys like Thiel, who you don't get the sense that they're hoping to usher humanity through this strange attractor at the end of time into the next reality, but themselves and a couple of their wealthy friends and maybe a few models.
Actual vampires. Yeah, very strange. It's funny because when I was doing that stuff, when I did H Plus Magazine because I was hired to do it, which I was always very direct about if I spoke. I always put myself in a position of having an ambiguous attitude towards this and having been hired for something that at least was interesting. So this is interesting and I know about it. And there are aspects of it that I find or found helpful, but I don't have a commitment to it. And it was understood that that was who I was and that was the situation. It's to the credit of the people who were running the H Plus group at that time that they wanted that, actually. And then I sold a book to a publisher about transhumanism and the singularity, and I snuck a fair bit of snark into that, at the same time informing people about technologies that might seem promising and about the different people and groups that were involved in that. And one of the things that, I mean, at that time, and that was just, I don't know, 3 years ago or something like that, there was a real wave within the transhumanist culture of people who were liberal and even left sort of objecting to how transhumanism was perceived, particularly in Europe. And I have a feeling that's been overwhelmed because that the people who are being attracted to those ideas are being attracted by very aggressive people with either libertarian or other types of right-wing views.
Right, because, I mean, transhumanism no longer seems like it's about humanity or human civilization transcending its current situation, but a few select individuals buying their way out of this situation and then watching the rest of us collapse in climate change. And I wonder, from your perspective, and maybe this is a good place to close, particularly because maybe you won't be as optimistic as I'm hoping you would be, but as someone who has, I know you're not a futurist, but you've, accurately watched the horizon. Are you hopeful about our state? I mean, I've got a 12-year-old daughter I'm thinking about, and gosh, I'm glad she's had 12 interesting years, but I don't know what's ahead. What do you think is coming, and what can we as a minority culture of humans really do to either navigate or steer this thing?
Yeah, I have to say that by any period of optimism that I've gone through is pretty well collapsed, you know, with presence of the Trump administration and just, I mean, the level of disinformation and confusion, and of course the very real problems that are likely to occur with the climate, that we don't have systems or ways of thinking about it or ways of living that are prepared to deal with that. I mean, the only way I can be optimistic is by going back to technology again. I mean, I don't really see an alteration in consciousness of, you know, reaching enough of 7 billion people or however many there are. Or I don't see a great kind of politics coming together on a mass scale worldwide. So, you know, the bigger problems like global warming and so forth have to be dealt with by clean energy, certainly. And I'm not sure. I mean, it might take some very scary technological hack to
some sorts of geoengineering, filings into the ocean,
which
oceans.
I'm totally afraid of. And
well, me
and,
too. We can't even give penicillin to someone, side effects.
I mean, my immediate politics of that is to oppose it completely. But you know, then again, when somebody asks me if there's any hope whatsoever for a future that isn't pretty dire, I go to climate change, and that's really the one that I can't understand or I think of a fix for, you know, and so you know, and I hate to leave it on a downer note, but that's
well, it's not a downer note if it gets people thinking about, you know, the reality of the situation, and that, you know, yes, we get to have more fun if we just clean up the planet a little bit first, and we can go back to some really good deep play.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do think, you know, that abundance might be still plausible. Some combination of the kind of localism that you've been advocating, but also with evolutions of things like nanotechnology and so forth. You know, I'm not completely pessimistic about whether this stuff will work. And if they work, can they be used for good purposes? I'm fairly pessimistic about that right now.
I guess, you know, I'm thinking that if the smartest people who are developing these technologies thought of the collective rather than the individual, you know, if they thought in terms of how are we going to keep this civilization going rather than how am I going to insulate myself from the impending collapse.
I mean, I think a lot of people do. I mean, a lot of people, you know, even in the mainstream of transhumanism, people like Peter Diamandis and so forth, you know, they are thinking broadly about how this stuff can make life here good for everybody and how it can be distributed. And they don't have very strong politics around it.
Right.
I think as things get more dire, a lot of those types of people are also thinking at the same time, how can I save myself and my family and close myself off from the consequences of what seems to be about to occur? I mean, somebody like Ray Kurzweil will say that you can have other events like World War II. You can have major events, but the singularity will still come. You know what I'm saying? It's like he can show on a chart how it didn't stop this rise, this doubling of information.
Right. And if we program the machines right, then once the singularity comes, then they're all going to make sure we take care of ourselves and one another.
Yep. Yeah, we'll make good pets. I always thought that song was by Perry Farrell was about robots, but I think he wrote it about aliens actually.
Yeah, oh, that'd be cute though. Worst case, we're pets. If they take care of us, then we'll get to play.
Yeah, I'm with it.
Well, I want to thank you for spending this time with me. And
it's been fun.
For all of your friendship and guidance over these years. I know a person with a moniker like Are You Serious? You wouldn't think is one of the steadiest and surest hands to guide through the chaos that's been this last 20 years, but you certainly have been, and my life wouldn't be the same.
It's the only possible response, actually.
Exactly.
All right, man. It's been fun talking to you.
You've been on Team Human, coming to you live from the Basement Media Squad at the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at Queens College. Our guest today was Are You Serious? You can find out more about Are You Serious and his music at areyouserious.bandcamp.com. Follow him at Steal This Singularity on Twitter, Steal This Singularity. And go to teamhuman.fm, where you can find links to Are You Serious' songs, the songs of his that we played on the show today, some of his essays and writings, and ways to contact him and get involved. Team Human is an entirely listener and speaker-supported program. We welcome any contributions or recurring ones at teamhuman.fm. where you can also find out about our guests and ways to get involved and ways to find the others. The show is produced by Stephen Bartolomew.
Stephen here. Thanks for listening to today's show. A shout out to all our friends out there connecting through Meetup. You can start your own Team Human Meetup at meetup.com. Thanks to Zago, who designed our logo. If you're enjoying the show, please pass it on and share a rating over at iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. My name is Stephen Bartolomew, and I'm on Team Human.
And I'm Douglas Rushka. Thanks so much for listening to Team Human this week. If you've got friends, associates, enemies who should join Team Human, please let them know about the show. The more of us there are, the better team we've got. This is Team Human, our last, best hope for peace.
Give the air controller. Customer.